Wistful Thinking is brought to you by the Cage Club Podcast Network. For more podcasts about movies and nostalgia, visit cageclub.me. That's cageclub.me.
Welcome to Wistful Thinking, where this month we are talking about the work of Jim Carrey. I'm Kara Gail O'Regan. With me is my co-host, Jordan Poland Clark.
Hi.
And oh wow, we have a lot of ground to cover today.
This escalated so quickly. like it went from me being like pulling your teeth out to make you watch a Jim Carrey movie. Mm. Tell us how many you watched since we last recorded.
9, I think. And one of those things was I watched twice, and then one of those things was an entire TV show.
So, yeah.
I've been on a journey with Jim Carrey. I've really come around on him. I watched that documentary on Netflix. Did you wind up watching that?
No.
Okay. Well, it was like finding a Rosetta Stone to understanding Jim Carrey. And I found it really interesting. And now I kind of like him? Question mark? I thought that, like, my comedic sensibility was, like, the polar opposite of his. And mm-hmm. What I've realized is that it's not all that different. They just manifest in very different ways. Like, he is, like, really an absurdist.
Yeah.
To a certain extent. And also, I started thinking, wait a minute. Are all Jim Carrey movies horror movies? Because that Ooh. Certainly casts things in a different light. And I think the answer to that question is actually kind of yeah.
I like that.
Yeah.
I've watched less than you have. And maybe this is just because of, like, my line of work. But I've come to think of him as a clown. Like, mm-hmm. a very, very good clown. Because the best clowns will make you feel every single emotion. And they'll also kind of, like, reflect society back at you mm-hmm. in different ways. You know, they all have kind of their own style and their own, you know, things that they make you feel. But I think he has made choices that do that really well.
Yeah. Yeah, that's interesting. I was, like, kind of all over the place as far as, like, what I was choosing to watch. I didn't, like, watch everything that he's done because he's done quite a lot, but kind of all over the place in theme and tone and different points in his career. And actually, the very last thing that I watched last night was a movie from 1985 called Once Bitten. Did you know that Jim Carrey was in a vampire movie? Because I did not.
I didn't either. What? How big was his part in it?
He's like the male lead, so he's wow. the star of the movie. Yeah. I kind of really liked it, actually. I mean, it certainly, like, has its problems, and there's, like, a lot of homophobia in the movie, which is not great. Mm-hmm. But he plays this, it's kind of like, I got a real kind of cross between Fast Times at Ridgemont High and Amy Heckerling's last movie, Vamps, mm-hmm. which you still really need to see. It's so good. But it was like those two movies kind of mixed up and combined, like not quite as good as an Amy Heckerling movie, but they were interesting and had great production design and kind of like a fun campy vampire movie where he plays this high schooler who he's a virgin and he's like trying to get his girlfriend to have sex with him, you know, classic 1980s movie. But he and his friends like go to a bar in Hollywood for an evening and there's this woman there who's a vampire and she needs to recruit some virgins to eat so that she can like stay young. That part of it was a little cloudy. You know, and then hilarity ensues. And the vampire is played by Lauren Hutton, who I love, and she's so beautiful. And, like, it just gets really weird, and they wind up having a threesome, and then, like, the next scene, like a dreamscape threesome, and then, like, the next scene, they're having an actual dance-off, which was amazing, and I think is worth watching the whole movie just for that that one dance scene because there's so many legs and they're all good legs. And it's just, you know, and Jim Carrey is like really like moving his body all crazy. It was great. But the thing that was really interesting about it was that it's like so early in his career, like you can tell that he's not like a fully, he doesn't have a sense of his like fully developed persona yet. Mm-hmm. So it was just like seeing like a tall, like it could have been a tall Tom Cruise or Michael J. Fox, you know, yeah. But like with these like weird moments of absurd like elasticity that were really fun. So I recommend that one. That was great.
Cool.
Yeah. And then we both watched The Cable Guy, which was
Well, was there anything chronologically in between?
Oh, yeah, he did some other things. He did some other things, and then he was on In Living Color, and then he made the three movies that came out in 1994, and then The Cable Guy was 96. Yeah.
Yeah. But you didn't watch anything else in between?
No.
Okay. Okay. So then I guess we get to talk about The Cable Guy.
Mm-hmm. Which, when I was watching it, this was what, like, put me on the Are All Jim Carrey movies horror movies.
Well, this
track.
Is definitely a horror movie.
For sure. I was like, wait, is this a horror movie about cable television? And the answer is yes.
Right. So if you haven't seen The Cable Guy, it stars Jim Carrey and Matthew Broderick. Matthew Broderick plays kind of a sad guy who has just broken up with his girlfriend and moved into his own apartment. And Jim Carrey comes to install his cable and then basically becomes a stalker. And the movie was originally meant to be kind of like just an annoying like friend comedy, but Jim Carrey and Judd Apatow basically took it and like blew it up and made it much, much darker than it was initially supposed to be. And Ben Stiller too, because Ben Stiller directed it.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
The three of them just kind of blew it up on purpose. It was originally supposed to star Chris Farley, who had to turn it down because of scheduling things. And you can really see, like, what... If you think of Chris Farley in the role, you can see
it's
what the movie was supposed
movie.
To
yeah.
be. And, audiences didn't like it because it was so dark. Well, one, it would just have been, like, a dumb... stupid movie that we wouldn't have even enjoyed watching now if that's what it was, but I really like it as an example of like basically the first time Jim Carrey on purpose made a choice that kind of blew up his own image,
and
which is like a fun thing that
purpose.
He does.
Yeah.
Like he definitely did it on purpose.
Interesting. I wrote, is this Scream but TV? Several question marks. Both came out the same year, so. Because, like, in the movie, there's this kind of, like, he's constantly, like, quoting movies and referencing TV shows and stuff like that. And it's, like, his brain has been so rotted by television that he's, like, so obsessed with it that it, like, drives him to, like, attempted homicide, basically.
When he also, like, just has no concept of...
of reality.
Of, like, reality or how to react in normal human relationships because everything he's doing is, like, basically based on television.
Yeah.
And also he's, like, a crazy criminal.
Also that.
This is... I want to read a quote that I copied. And honestly, I can't remember where it's from anymore. It's probably from the AV Club because that's where I usually go when I'm like, ooh, how was this received? It says, of course, it's that very shattering of expectations, the abuse of them, even, that makes The Cable Guy so much more fascinating, so much better than its detractors have always insisted. At the height of his popularity, Carrey took a risk on a dark, alienating stalker comedy. And according to Apatow, the comedian played a very active role in the subversion of his own star power, the pushing of his character in increasingly unsympathetic directions. A cruelly hilarious experiment in audience agitation, The Cable Guy was was also the first sign that there was more to its in-demand leading man than rubbery features and a brave, almost pathological willingness to look foolish.
Mm-hmm.
And I find that all to be very true.
Yeah. I'm just reading some of the things that I copied from one of the profiles that I had read of him. He said, quote, "My plan was not to join Hollywood, it was to destroy it. Like, take a giant sledgehammer to the leading man and to all the seriousness." Which really, you can see it in, like, every single movie he's made. Maybe, like, except for those really early ones from the 80s, where he hadn't quite figured that out mm-hmm. yet.
You can really see, and I feel like this is easier to talk about when talking about The Truman Show, which is, I think, mm-hmm. the next movie that we watched, right? Because the only one in between those two is Liar Liar, and you didn't watch that, did you?
No, thank you.
So you can really see it in The Truman Show, and then also, again, in Eternal Sunshine. Like, he's really good at being, like, a very regular guy
mm-hmm.
with, like, a lot of both, like, sadness and also, like, determination. Mm-hmm. Like, he's able to, like, seem very, very regular and look very, very regular.
And then still do these, like, extraordinarily wild things with his...
Yeah.
With his career, with his face, with his body, like, in so many different ways.
But he also is able to be really subtle.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he can go both ways depending on, like, whatever he thinks the part calls for.
Yeah.
Because in The Truman Show, plays a guy who's, like, a little bit silly.
Mm-hmm.
But is also just, like, very, very, very regular.
Yeah.
Very normal guy.
Like, and he was doing that, like, at the height of his fame, too, mm-hmm. which is so interesting. Like, that's I guess maybe not the height of his fame. That was probably in, like, 94, 95. But, like, he had been super, super famous for long enough that, like, you would think that he would have no concept of how to do that anymore.
Well, yeah, it's just not what made him famous. Like,
yeah.
Like, I feel like, I mean, even I remember being aware of this so The Truman Show was 98, so I was 12, and I saw it when it came out, and even I remember being like, oh, he's doing a serious thing now.
Mm-hmm.
Like, oh, this is different. But even when I was 12, I really liked the movie.
Yeah, and it really blew my mind watching it this time around.
It was, before we get into it, The Truman Show is, again, from 1998, stars Jim Carrey as a guy who, from the moment he was born, was the star of a TV show, and he's the only one who doesn't know it. Like, they basically created an entire world just for him. Everyone is an actor except for him.
Yeah.
And
I had extremely intense emotional reaction when I was watching it. Because like not only is he like is everyone, you know, so aware of the fact that like he's not just a TV show, like he is a TV show that's watched by everyone all of the time, it seems. Like even like the Kardashian level of fame is not to the level I feel like that this
No, because it's really so different is. Than that. Like it's a 24-hour
yeah
TV network basically. And it's,
yeah, and like the Kardashians like are very mainstream, but like not everyone watches their show or whatever. Like
no.
People know who they are but don't necessarily watch the show. Like in this movie it seems like everyone is watching this kind of like all of the time glued to their TV sets, and I was
and everyone's been watching it, you know,
for his literally his entire life. Yeah, yeah. And I was so anxious the whole time I was watching it, just like thinking about how like mortifying and invasive and traumatizing it would be to find out that your entire life was a TV show produced without your consent and like the whole world is watching it for entertainment and you're the only one who didn't know. And then like also literally every person you know and love has been aggressively gaslighting you about mm-hmm. like the fundamental truth of your existence. Like yeah. that really like set me off like to an extent that I was like crying through most of the movie and it like really fucked up my day. But it was fascinating. Like it was an incredibly well-made movie and like, you know, for like to be able to like evoke such strong emotion, I think is like really incredible.
This is when I'm going to cry for the first time. I told Kara that like I'm having a really crying day and like these movies, the next two, we'll probably talk about some in between, but I watched The Truman Show and Eternal Sunshine and they're both like very emotional movies.
Yeah.
And so I'm totally going to cry talking about them. And this is the first time I'm going to cry because I just thought, like, the thing that I hold on, I have to cry first, and then I'll say it. Okay. The thing that, like, really struck me about The Truman Show as an adult is that, like, one of the main takeaways that I had this time that I never had before is that you can't, like, they set up this whole world to keep him inside the world, and they couldn't do it, you know? Like, there's just no, like, when someone is determined to do something, and they decide to do it, you can't, like, you couldn't crush his spirit, you know? You just couldn't do it. And not only that, but, like, the people watching it, like, they were rooting for him to escape it.
Yeah.
Like, they were on his side. They wanted him to get out. And I feel like, that's the turn, kind of. Like, to me, once, you could tell that the people watching it, a lot of them understood that even though he didn't know it, he was trying to escape.
Well, because everyone is trying to escape.
And, yeah, and it's like, I just love that they were all rooting for him, you know?
Yeah.
It's still really fucked up because of all the things that you said.
Yeah, of course. But, yeah, I didn't think about that, and you're so right. Because, in addition to, like, showing his life, him going about his day, you also see, like, outside of that world, people watching it on TV. And one of the people, actually, that's watching it is this guy in a bathtub. And that guy is the same actor who plays Napoleon in Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure, one of my favorite movies and one of my favorite characters in that movie. He's so good. And like, he doesn't have to say a word and he's like, you're just, his name is Terry Camilleri. And I'm obsessed with him. It was like, oh my God, it's Napoleon in a bathtub. It was exciting. It's really interesting to me, though, that we could both have such strong emotional reactions to this movie for completely different reasons.
No, I mean, I had the same emotional reaction as you for that reason also.
Yeah.
But I had always had that reaction to it. Like, yeah. The one I talked about was just like, I never saw it that way before.
Yeah. Well, there's a moment towards the end of the movie where he is escaping, and he's on this boat and he reaches the very outer edge of this world and the boat actually like pierces the barrier and he touches the wall and he just makes this face. And this goes back to what you were saying before about Jim Carrey's ability to do something very subtle and still full of emotion. He touches the wall and he makes this face that's just like, I'm not crazy after all. And that really like, that was the thing that ruined my day. I mean, like, it was reassuring that this character that I was rooting for finds out that he's not crazy after all. But I have been in serious situations where I felt like I was crazy and everyone was telling me I was crazy. And then to find out that you're not actually crazy and there is something going on is like a really powerful moment. And the fact that he was able to do that just like with a face. And all he says is, oh. He doesn't have to say anything else. He just makes a face and says, oh. And I was like sobbing.
You know, like the thing that really got me about that part, and I've been trying to figure out why, is like, and I think I just figured part of it out maybe, but for some reason, like, so after I noticed when I was watching that part, I really noticed his wardrobe. Like, he's wearing a turtleneck sweater and like khaki pants with a belt, and his shirt's tucked in. He, like, it's the most, like, regular, boring outfit, because that's who Truman is, I feel like.
Mm-hmm.
But there's something about it that seems that it's, like, there's still, like, for some reason, so much, like, dignity in that. And, like he's at his, like, lowest low, right?
Yeah.
He is, like, you can kill me right now, or I'm getting out of here, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know, there's just something about the way he's put together and like the choice of having that character still wear I don't know, there was something, I couldn't stop thinking about his turtleneck.
That's amazing. I did not notice his wardrobe at all whatsoever, and that's usually like,
I don't know,
I'm
why
paying more attention to that.
I
yeah.
don't know why that's what got me, but it was.
Yeah.
And I think now, thinking about it, like, that's definitely part of it. It's just that, like, there is so much dignity in mm-hmm. it, you know?
Yeah. Laura Linney plays his wife in the world. And, of course, she's in on the plot. But when he starts freaking out because he's, like, figured out that, like, something is going on, and she's afraid that he is going to hurt her, they're, like, in the house, and he's kind of, like, chasing her around. And she still has this smile on her face, even though she's like,
so
Truman,
creepy.
You're scaring me. Yeah. She's so good.
Well,
I mean,
and
she's
you can tell,
great,
she just, like, wants to be professional, you know? Like,
mm-hmm.
you can tell that she
yeah,
takes
and she
her
even
job
yells,
very
like,
seriously.
This is an unsafe work
yeah.
environment.
Yeah. Like, she just thinks she's doing a job.
Yeah. Which is, you know, so heartbreaking. That, like, to her, this is just a job, and, like, to him, like, this is his life. That's his wife. That's a woman that he loves. Oh, God. Oof.
Yeah.
It also made me want to delete all of my social media accounts and throw my phone into the sea.
Yeah, I mean, like, what a commentary on something that didn't even exist yet.
Yeah. I think
but
it was
it did,
more,
you know,
a commentary on reality TV, which
yeah,
did
for
exist.
Sure.
But it has, like, grown in so many ways. And, like, with the addition of social media, I think that
yeah.
this film is, like, fascinating and so prescient. And I think the same actually is true of The Cable Guy. I was, like, really impressed by its take on media and how it kind of infects our lives
yeah.
and also like had some interesting thoughts on like the Internet of Things, which definitely didn't exist back then.
No, but yeah, it's like shocking how these two movies that are, you know, 20 years old now, over 20 years old, still felt like incredibly relevant
yeah
in their themes.
Which actually is a good transition to talking about Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, which I watched twice, once just regular, and then I have, like, the original DVD, and I watched the director's commentary
Ooh.
With Michel Gondry, and it also had the writer, Charlie Kaufman, is that
uh-huh.
the guy?
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Yep.
He didn't say much, but it was actually really funny, because Michel Gondry is, like, so evocative with his language and, like, you know, really expressive, and then he'd be like, Charlie, do you agree? And be like, sure, yeah. Really quite funny. But that was really fascinating, because it gives so much insight into how the movie got made, just not just from like a conceptual standpoint of like how this idea came to life, but also like from a technical standpoint, they talked about like a lot of really interesting things. And it made me think about the tech in the movie, because I don't know, you describe the movie and then I'll keep talking.
Oh, so Eternal Sunshine is about a world. Well, it's about a couple. It's about Jim Carrey and Kate
Kate
Winslet.
Winslet, who is my heart.
God,
I love her so
I mean,
much.
they're both just horrible people in this. Like, I hate them
Yeah.
both. You're supposed to.
Well, I think, both of them are dealing with untreated mental illness.
Yes,
And maybe if
absolutely.
they like got some therapy and like got on the right medications, like they'd be fine. They'd be
But
good
both of them
people.
are in
They'd be
complete
great people.
denial.
Yeah.
And they're really, it seems as though they're really in a relationship to look to save themselves from their mental illness rather than doing the work themselves.
Yeah.
And the movie is also a commentary on that, because
Yeah.
that is like not only a thing that people do in real life, but also like a trope that shows up in movies
Yeah. And I would
over
say
and
that's
over and over.
more true of Jim Carrey's character in the movie because there's very little of Clementine, Kate Winslet's character. Like, there's very little of her in real life, and most of it is his recollection of
Right.
her, his idea of her, his imagination of her.
Right, because so it's this couple, they break up, and Kate Winslet's character Clementine has go gets a procedure that erases Jim Carrey's character Joel, his name is Joel, from her mind. Like, she has zero memory of him. And he
And
comes to
this is
find
a
out. 2 year
relationship, so
Right. And
there
he
goes 2 years
comes
of your
to
life.
find out that she's done this and decides to do the same thing. And so the movie is basically us going with him on this procedure. It's like us going into his brain with him
Yeah.
while he has her erased.
Yeah, and it's so like
And it also
interesting the way they do that.
follows the technician doing the erasing, played by his name?
I don't know. I
Oh my
can't.
God.
I
Hold on,
d
I'll look it up.
there's
He's very famous.
he's very famous, yeah. Wait, are you talking about the doc? You're talking about the technician, not the doctor.
Yeah, the
Okay.
technician.
It's one of two guys. I can
Oh my
never tell them
God. I'm
apart
so mad that I
or
can't
remember
remember
their
his
name. Is
name.
it
Wait.
Mark Ruffalo?
It's Mark Ruffalo, yeah.
Okay. Who's the
Like
other
a very
guy?
schlubby
Sam
Mark
Rockwell. I always
Ruffalo.
get the two of them
Oh, I can see that.
confused.
But
They're
so
like the same
I
shape.
often think of Mark Ruffalo as like kind of hot,
Yeah, oh, for sure.
and Sam Rockwell is not.
Oh, I think
And
they're both pretty cute. Anyway.
but I like Mark Ruffalo in this because he's kind of schlubby and like,
Yeah.
so it also follows him and Kirsten Dunst plays like the receptionist, like administrative assistant at the business, and it follows her. And also the doctor who has come up with this procedure.
So there's like different worlds that you're in because you're in the real world with these people. You're in Joel's mind, and then you're in, well, I guess there's two worlds, right? So,
Well, but I also think, yes, there are two worlds. There's both like real life and then Joel's mind, but like Joel's mind also has kind of multiple layers also.
right. Because he realizes after the procedure starts that he actually like because on paper this sounds like a good idea, but then you're not just erasing the bad memories, you're erasing the good ones too. And so he realizes that he doesn't want this, and so he's like trying to hide from the procedure, which they have like mapped his brain and mapped his memories and are going through and basically causing brain damage so that they will not be there anymore. And so this the company that does this is called Lacuna. This movie was made in like 2003, and I think that the technology that they're using, even though it's already like very kind of like low tech, and almost like analog in some ways, like doesn't look or seem like it's that old. You know what I mean? Like the fact that it, and they talked about this on the commentary, they wanted it to always be like kind of low tech. And then Michel Gondry said something like, it's like going to Kinko's to get your brain fixed. Mm-hmm. Because not just is this like a medical and neurological procedure, but these are people who are working a customer service job and their mm-hmm. lives are going on. And like this is just another day at work to them, which mm-hmm. I found really interesting.
Have you ever seen The Science of Sleep?
Yeah, yeah. Also a Michel Gondry movie. I love his work.
I really like the directors. Way he shows dreams. Mm-hmm. They're just like, it's like he has a very specific style.
Yeah.
And clearly that's a topic that he's interested in.
Yeah.
Just like, I really like the weirdness of dreams and like the shameful things that show up in your dreams, and I like the way that he does that. I don't even like, it's very different. Like I wouldn't even really totally know what to compare him to besides like mm-hmm. some other surrealist things, but he has right. such a style that I really like the way that matches Charlie Kaufman's style, mm-hmm. which is like often also very surreal. And, right. like, very, very layered. Like, there's always, like, so many things yeah. going on in a Charlie
Kaufman
movie. And
they were talking about how, like, you're not really supposed to get all of this movie on the first watch. Like, this is, they made a movie that you can watch over and over again and, like, see new things, which is an interesting way to think about it.
I had forgotten, like you had watched it, and I was like, all right, I'm going to watch it, but I feel worried that it's, like, gonna be too like manic pixie dream girl like, and I'm gonna be annoyed by some of the themes in it, and you were like, no, that's what it's about, like don't worry, they know. And it was you were right, like they're just so spot on about like that particular trope. Like Kate Winslet has a line that she says twice because she doesn't know that she said it the first time. Where she's like, I'm just a fucked up girl looking for my own peace of mind. Like, I'm not here to save you. I'm not going to save you. Please right. don't look at me like I'm going to.
But I get the impression that, like, this is a speech that she has to break out every right. time a mm-hmm. guy becomes obsessed with her. Because, mm-hmm. like, this happens and they think that she's going to be the thing that's going to, you know, get them out of their funk or save them. And, like, she's right. She's just a fucked up girl with her own problems. And, mm-hmm. like, is not a superhero, is not a mental health professional, and is not here to save you. Mm-hmm. And so I said that, it, like, the movie is kind of almost about the idea of the manic pixie dream girl and not mm-hmm. so much just using that tired old trope.
I also... So the movie opens... And we don't know this at the time, but the opening of the movie is... Joel and Clementine meeting again after they've had their memories erased, because they both just like, even though they're erased, they both like held on to this idea and this like distant memory of where they met, which was in Montauk. And they,
so they know that this place is important to them and it's special to them, but they don't know why.
Neither one of them knows why.
Yeah.
And they both go there and meet again. And like each other and then find out, you know, their history. And to me, that's also like a really interesting idea of like, even if you start to erase things, you erase people, you erase memories, it's like you still can't change who you fundamentally are in some ways.
Yeah.
And it's like both like reassuring and sad in some ways, like because then they're just standing there knowing what their history is, knowing the horrible things that they've said about each other after being in a relationship for 2 years. And they still can't help but, like, be attracted to each other and still... The movie ends... You don't know what happens when the movie ends. you can't tell if they're going to try to have a relationship again or if mm-hmm. they're just going to be like, nope, this is a bad idea. We know how this ends. But yeah, I find it like both sad and reassuring. Like, yeah. it's like they did all this work to get rid of each other and they still just so are fundamentally who they are that they're not different.
Yeah. Well, I had read something really interesting, which is that the original ending to the movie, like in the screenplay, was that I forget exactly how it was supposed to go, but at some point you find out that like it jumps into the future and you find out that Clementine has actually had this procedure several times over the years.
Well, I'd believe that.
Yeah. And I understand why they didn't do that and they left it open to interpretation. And even the last scene of them like wrestling in the snow on the beach, you don't know if that's an old memory, you don't know if that's a new yeah. thing. So mm-hmm. it just really leaves it open to interpretation. But I would love to also see, or maybe actually my dream scenario is that they make a sequel to the movie, but from Clementine's perspective.
Yeah, that'd be interesting.
You know, I well, think and it's that also, would be really cool.
I also like got the feeling that we, like, even though we spend time with these characters, even if most of the time we spend with the Clementine character is not actually her, it's, you know, whoever he thinks she is.
Yeah.
Even after that, I don't feel as a viewer that I know either character very well.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
And I think that's on purpose because I don't think either character
they don't know
knows themselves very
absolutely.
Well.
Yeah.
And so that's all, like, whatever, like, that's all we're allowed to have also.
Yeah. Well, so we also, at the end of the movie, find out that Mary, Kirsten Dunst's character, had the procedure done herself. And it's because she fell in love with her boss. And instead of quitting her job, just had this procedure done so they could just go about their lives like nothing ever happened.
Mm-hmm.
But you see throughout the movie that she like has a little bit of a crush on him and is kind of sweet on him. And so I think, again, like we were talking about with the previous two films, that they were so like prescient about the future of technology and media and stuff. In this case, like, we know so much more about the brain now than we did when this movie was made or when they wrote the screenplay, which, like, the process of developing the film, I think, took like 7 years. It took a really long time. But like, what we know now about neuroplasticity and about how, you know, like pathways in your brain form and then get reinforced over and over again. I think we have so much more of a sophisticated understanding of how memory works and stuff like that. And this movie still nailed it that, like, yeah, you can go in and like create little holes in your brain, but like the connections between things still are there and mm-hmm. like will still kind of lead you down the same roads without you even really realizing. And something Jim Carrey worked with Michel Gondry again recently on the Showtime show Kidding, which mm-hmm. I watched all mm-hmm. of, which is, I mean, it's phenomenal. It's so good in so many ways. And we'll talk about it a little bit more in a little while. But there's even a scene in that show where one of the characters like oversimplifies the concept of neuroplasticity and makes a joke about it. And I was like, oh, that's really interesting that these two people are working together again, kind of on some of the same themes and ideas.
Yeah. I also think this was just like another fun way for him to blow up his image.
Oh, for sure.
Because what?
Okay, what? Sorry. This was just really exciting and I forgot about it for a second and I wanted to tell you immediately when I heard it and then I was like, no, save it for the podcast. So on the director's commentary, Michel Gondry says that he told Kate Winslet to play Jim Carrey in this movie. And you can't have two Jim Carreys in a movie, so they're their character types are flipped. Which
I
found
that. And
so
it does feel like an unusual role for her too.
Yeah. He gave her the direction that like she should be inside out and told him that he should be outside in. And he really like struggled like when they were like improvising scenes and stuff, he would do funny things and say funny things, and Michel Gondry would be like, stop doing that. And he really like struggled with that, was really annoyed and like, why won't you let me be funny? Which I find really interesting.
Yeah, I mean, he's just like the most depressing person in this.
Yeah, he's a real sad sack. There are some other things from the director's commentary that I did not realize. A woman was the director of photography on this. Isn't that cool?
Mm-hmm.
And it's such a beautifully shot movie, and I think so much of it is really iconic, like that shot of them lying on the ice next to the crack and stuff. Mm-hmm. But back to what you were saying before about Michel Gondry, is like the way that he is able to kind of create a really real feeling kind of dreamscapes. The way that he and the cinematographer kept getting in arguments because she likes to use a lot of smoke in shots, because it like changes the density of the air, and so the light passes through it differently, and especially when you're using artificial lighting, it can make it look, give it more of like a naturalistic look. And he kept telling her like, stop using so much smoke, and she would like argue with him. And he, like, watching it back during the director's commentary, was like, I have to apologize, because like obviously this was like a really good use of that, and we probably should have used it more, which I found really interesting. It was also edited by a woman, and I think so much of this movie is editing. Like, they shot a ton of footage, and so it was like a matter of like cutting and recutting over and over again until they got it like just the way it came out. And Michel Gondry said something interesting, that like, watching the movie back now or then, because they did the commentary like right after it was finished, I guess, but he said that it was like he had this idea of what the movie was going to be like in his head, and then watching it back, it's a completely different thing. The way that, like, if you talk to somebody on the phone, you have this idea of what they're going to be like, and then you meet them, and they're totally different. And he said it was like meeting his movie, and I found that really interesting. And then they also talked a lot about the score by John Bryan, who is a great musician. He's the preferred music person for like Paul Thomas Anderson, and has worked with a lot of really great people.
He did one of my favorite movie scores, which is I Heart Huckabees.
That's one of my favorite movie scores too. I wrote a paper on it in art school.
It's because it's so good.
Yeah, and I lent my professor my DVD of the movie because he had not seen it, and he never gave it back.
So, oh.
Yeah. That's fine. I'm not sure that movie would hold up.
I'm not sure either. I think about it a lot.
Yeah. Well, maybe we'll rewatch that at some point. I think that's all the notes that I took about that one. Kirsten Dunst wears a fantastic purple velvet blazer that I love a lot.
Oh, I didn't notice. Which part?
And the part where, like, she comes over to Joel's apartment while they're doing the procedure.
Oh.
Kate Winslet's hair color. Do you have anything to say about that?
Her hair?
Yeah.
It's pretty good.
It is pretty good. They did it with wigs. I think this
Those are good wigs.
They're great wigs. Then. Yeah. But I think this might have been when I started dyeing my hair all sorts of colors.
This was like just after I stopped dyeing my hair all those colors.
Yeah. The reason that I wanted to do this movie, when I watched it the first time, I was like, oh my god, I forgot, like, 2004 was like a very important year for me in my creative development, and this movie was definitely a part of that. I was a junior/senior in high school. I did like a pre-college art program where I lived in Brooklyn for a month over the summer, and was like doing art things. It was like, I think it was the first time that I really like started looking at film as an art form, and like starting to understand that was a thing, Because at that program, they like showed us a few movies, and I was like, oh yeah, I guess movies.
Which movies were they?
It was a documentary about naked mole rats. Mm-hmm. I don't know why we watched that.
Interesting.
I should hunt that down and watch it again and see if I would have a better understanding of it now. What was that Lars von Trier movie with Bjork? Dancer in the Dark.
Yep. Oh my god, the saddest movie that's ever existed.
And then you, like, ugh. Also, he was, like, terrible to her the whole time, and that's why she's not in movies anymore. Yeah, I have not seen that since. Another saddest movie ever made, City of God, which is a Brazilian movie.
I've never seen that one. I have heard of it.
Yeah, about, like, kids growing up in the favelas. That was very sad, but also, like, beautiful and brilliant. And there might have been another one, but those are the three that I remember. On, like, Friday nights to keep us from going and doing bad things, they made us, like, gather in an auditorium and watch films. So, oh, and the soundtrack to this movie, too. There's a Beck song, which it turns out is a cover. I did not know that. But
of what?
Some obscure song from the 80s that like Michel Gondry would like go around and be like, does anybody remember this song? And he would like sing it to people and they wouldn't know what he was talking about. And then he was talking to John Bryan and was like, oh, there's a song and I can't find it. And he sings a little bit of it. And John Bryan was like, oh, hey, wait a minute. And he had like recorded a cover of it earlier that week.
Wow.
Or the week before it. Yeah.
It's that makes sense because it's a very not Beck song.
Yeah, well,
like, to the point where I was like,
Beck
sings this, but I need to Google it because I'm not sure.
That was on his record Sea Change, which was a very not Becky album, but is very good, and I listened to it a lot in high school. Can we do a Kirsten Dunst month next month? I forgot how cute she is, and then I watched this movie and I was like,
well, and we've been meaning to watch The Virgin Suicides anyway. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And she, I mean, talk about somebody who has made a lot of really interesting decisions in the latter part of their career. Cool. Okay. Yes. But not Kirsten Dunst month yet. Let's keep going. do you have anything else to say about Eternal Sunshine?
I don't think so. Okay. Oh, I do want to say that I really like, I think this is just a thing that I like about Michel Gondry, is that he, when he can, I think, uses a lot of practical effects rather than CG.
Oh, he does. Yeah, that was another thing that I did want to talk about. So many of the effects in this movie are either, like, in-camera or practical effect kind of stuff. Like, that scene in the kitchen, in his, like, memory as a little boy.
Yeah.
Where she comes in as his mom's friend. That's actually all shot on one set. It's like a forced perspective. So in the front, the table like is smaller, and then in the back is bigger. And they, yeah, very cool.
I love that. It gives his work like such a specific
tactile, I think, is the word that I would use for it. Yeah.
Yeah, that's a good word for it.
And then like in the scenes, like as his memories are being erased and he's like looking at the doctor and looking at other people and they don't have a face, that is the skin of Michel Gondry's knee that they just like superimposed over their faces.
Cool.
Yeah. Yeah. So there's like all these like little things in there. But Charlie Kaufman said that he had like in the screenplay, there's tons of snow. Like he had written so much snow into the screenplay, but when you shoot a film, like you have no idea if it's going to snow or not. So he had to go through and like basically delete it all. And then they happened to shoot during this like very snowy cold winter, and that's why there wound up being so much snow in the movie, which I think is really cool. The studio had wanted them to shoot in Canada to keep the cost lower. But Michel Gondry, like, this is a very like French filmmaking thing, it like insists on shooting on location for the most part. And so they wound up not having as much in the budget for special effects, and that's why it is so also like especially kind of low tech, which I think like works perfectly for this film.
Yes, it does.
Yeah. Okay. So the next thing I watched, and this was something that I watched last night, a movie called I Love You, Philip Morris from 2009.
Seen that.
Yeah, that was unexpected.
Yeah.
Not the movie I thought I was going to be watching. Do you remember it at all?
No, not totally. I haven't seen it in probably. I mean, I saw it when it came out, so I haven't seen it in 9 years.
Yeah. It was interesting. He plays a con man who he starts the movie married to a woman and then has a near-death experience and is like, no, I'm gay and I need to live my truth. So he does that and then is like, being gay is very expensive. So he starts like conning people and winds up in prison and then meets, oh, what's his name?
Ewan McGregor.
That guy, yeah, meets him, who's also in prison, for like a petty crime, and they fall in love, and then it becomes this like kind of sweet gay rom-com, but in prison, and then he gets out of prison, and he continues conning people, and then they both wind up back in prison, and then he fakes his own death. It's like a whole convoluted thing and tries and like escapes from prison like 15 different times. But yeah, that was just unexpected. I don't know what I was expecting going into it. And like at every turn, I was like, oh, okay, this is not the movie that I expected. I think it's notable because it's there is tragedy in the movie, but unlike a lot of the body of queer cinema in history, it doesn't have like an extremely heartbreaking, tragic ending as most gay films do, which I appreciated. Like the to like it is tragic, but the tone of it is very different. But it also felt a little bit like a gay movie made by straight people.
Which it probably was.
Yeah. I couldn't find any information about that, but yeah, just unexpected. I don't love it. It bothers me when people make lighthearted things about prison because our prison culture is very real and very a very dire situation and very fucked up. And like this was my problem with Paddington too, even though it is set in the UK. I was like, I still am uncomfortable with this lighthearted children's movie about prison. This
I
does not feel okay with me.
had a
But
similar experience. I'm still binge watching Brooklyn Nine-Nine, and there's a story arc where two of the main characters are wrongfully accused of a bank robbery and go to jail, and I had similar feelings about that when they were in jail.
It just makes me uncomfortable.
Yeah.
Which I think was a big criticism of Orange is the New Black in like the first season, and then it got way darker, and then people were like, oh, it's not as funny anymore. It's like, yeah, because prison is fucking dark. Fucked up shit. Like, that's some fucked up shit. We put, you know, humans in cages, and then whatever. We don't need to get into that. Did you have anything else to say about that movie?
No, I haven't seen it in so long. I remember like having a similar feeling as you, being like, oh, this isn't what I thought it was. Interesting. But then also not liking it as much as I wanted to like it.
Yeah. Oh, that's a good way to put it. Yes, I agree. And then the other two things that I watched was that Jim and Andy documentary, which I've already talked about. And the TV show Kidding, which has been on Showtime for one season. And in that, he plays a Mr. Rogers type kids show guy named Mr. Pickles, and it's a show where his father is like the executive producer and showrunner, and his sister, played by Catherine Keener, who always amazing, is like their creative director, and she is like the head puppet maker. Oh my God, there's so many puppets on this show. It's so wonderful, and they have that like weird Michel Gondry feel to them because
Ooh, I love it.
He has directed a lot of the episodes and I think is one of the executive producers. There's even And Joey didn't tell me about this, and I was like, how could you have not told, like, this would have gotten me to watch the show so much sooner. There is a puppet that is a French baguette, and his name is Henri. And I just love him so much, and it's such a good show. But so the show is like a very dark comedy, because Mr. Bickler, I think his name is Jeff Pickles. In real life, Jeff has these two twin boys, and his one of the sons died in a car accident. So, like, right off the bat, we're dealing with child death on this comedy show, which is, a very taboo topic that is something that people deal with and we don't talk about as a culture. And it can be, not just the purgatorial torment of grief, but also, being so isolated by the fact that, like, no one wants to mention that your kid died. And so Mr. Pickles wants to do an episode of the show about death, and his father is like, we cannot do that, it will traumatize the children. And so over the course of the season of Kidding, Jeff Pickles kind of unravels. Like, the show starts maybe like a month or two after his son's death, and he seems to be fine. He and his wife have separated, and his other son is acting out, which is all to be expected. But he seems to be holding it together, except for the fact that he wants to do this weird show about death. And then he, like, progressively unravels over the course of the season, making, like, more and more weird television that the editors are like, we have seven usable minutes, like, we can't keep doing this, we're on PBS, there's no commercial breaks, come on. And over the course of the season, he meets this woman with terminal cancer, and they start dating, and she's written so well, and they have sex scenes, and it, like, that whole thing, like, it's not, we She's written like a real person and not like a cancer patient, which is cool. And there's even a sex scene, and, like, she's topless and has a chest port, which is how people who receive intravenous fluids, medication, etc., a lot, you wind up getting one of those or like a PICC line so that, like, they don't destroy all your veins. And it, like, pokes out a little bit in your chest, and it's something that, like, it's a thing that I know a lot of people who have them just for, like, chronic illness purposes, or people who have or have had cancer, and that's a thing that we never see, and so, like, to see that on TV, and not just on TV, but, like, in a sex scene where, like, a woman is enjoying herself was, like, very moving to me. And Leslie, no, not Leslie Mann. She was in the movie I was just talking about. What is her name? Oh my God, she's so good. Fuck, hang on. Judy Greer. How could I possibly have
Oh, I
forgotten
can
her
see why
name?
you mix them up, though.
Yeah, same approximate size and color. So Judy Greer plays his ex-wife, and she is always amazing. And this was not at all surprising, but she's incredible in the show because they actually, like, let her, like, be serious and not just absurd serious, but, like, she's playing this mother who has lost her son and is, like, going through all of these changes in her life. And so it's really great to see her in a part like that. So highly recommend. The show is so good. It's funny, it's sad, it's absurd, it's wonderful, the whole thing. So that's it. That's all the things that I watched, or at least all the things that have Jim Carrey in it. I've been spending a lot of time on the couch.
Two things. One, do you follow Rob Delaney at all?
Not really, no. But I do
He
know that he lost a child to cancer, right?
talks about it in a way that I don't know that I've ever heard other people talk about. I like him a lot for he has so many layers for somebody who is a comedian who can really easily be seen as just a comedian. He has so many layers.
Well, that are really similar to Jim Carrey.
Yeah. I also wanted to go back to the cable guy for a second,
mm-hmm.
because I was reading my notes and I wrote down one other quote that probably is from the same article that I didn't write down what it was from, where they basically compare the way Jim Carrey is treating Matthew Broderick to the way that
men treat women
are treated by men,
yep.
which I just thought
was... Yeah, because he's like a crazy ex-girlfriend type.
Yeah.
Interesting.
So it says, thankfully the film doesn't code Carrey's character as a gay predator. If anything, it's making Broderick a proxy for every woman who's tried to politely sidestep the persistent advances of someone she's not interested in.
Oh, interesting.
And
I
was like, ooh.
Think it works both ways of, like, the way that men treat women as, like, a crazy ex-girlfriend, but I didn't think about it in the other way around.
But Jim Carrey actually is crazy. Like, your thing would be true if he was not actually a crazy person,
mm-hmm.
but he is.
Well, yeah, that's fair. But also, yes, you're right, the way that women have to deal with overly attentive men. That's a
and Matthew Broderick just like constantly feels bad,
yeah.
you know, about like saying no or like pushing him away or like.
But
drawing
also, he's
really
an asshole too.
Oh, for sure. But he has a problem drawing boundaries,
yeah.
which I think is a thing that many women also struggle
mm-hmm.
with.
Well, we're taught not to have any, so
yeah,
we're usually starting from nothing. That's really interesting. They go to medieval times in that movie. That made me laugh. In the cable guy.
They do go to medieval times, and Janine Garofalo is their waitress.
Yeah. Also, the thing that, like, makes Matthew Broderick want to try and, like, turn his life around is that he sees an infomercial, and it's, like, a very young Tony Robbins. And I was like, holy shit, it's Tony Robbins. Have you seen that documentary, I Am Not Your Guru?
No, but I remember when it came out.
Oh, man, it's fucking wild.
Weird.
It's really interesting. I am fascinated by cult and cult-adjacent figures,
hmm.
and I think he's very much one of those. Did you know that he, like, doesn't actually clap? He just pretends to clap?
What?
It's insane. Yeah. So, like, instead of clapping, he will, like, bring his palms together quickly, but not actually touch them.
Why?
I don't remember, but I just think that's insane. Oh, right. I'm driving the boat. I forgot.
Ooh, it's a boat now.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, spring's coming. So. Gotta get it ready for the water. Do you have any other thoughts about Jim Carrey?
No. No, but I'm glad you came around about him.
Me too. This has been quite an adventure. I mentioned it on our What Am I Chewing episode, but didn't really talk about it in the last one. His artwork is really interesting. He took up visual art in 2011 and started painting, and since the 2016 election has been drawing political cartoons, which are very interesting. You know, for someone who this is like a recent thing, he has a really good handle on like perspective and color,
mm-hmm.
and I think his art's mostly very, very interesting. Not always good, but I showed some of it to my boyfriend, and he was like, well, it's very like ham-fisted, and I was like, well, that's Jim Carrey. Like, I feel like his creative output is kind of like, regardless of how it manifests itself is still like vibrating on the same wavelength, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So it's interesting to see it come out in a visual way. He also does some sculpture work, and he made a giant naked woman for his garden, which is weird, but whatever. People have been making naked ladies in art since the beginning, so nothing new. But apparently, when the full moon comes out, it, like, lights up her eyes because she's a moon goddess. So.
Ooh, I like that.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm tired. Jordan, if people wanted to find you, where should they look?
I'm on Instagram @JordoPC.
Yeah, and I am also on Instagram at Bimps. Wistful Thinking is on Instagram at Wistful Pod, even though I have not updated it in a while. You can write us an email, wistfulpod@gmail.com. Do whatever, or don't. It's fine. We'll talk to you next time. Bye.
Bye.